Welcome to the No Direction Podcast, PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage. Remember, we con when you can't.
It's fight time.
20 quatlers.
No, go back in your idle animation.
Morning, everybody.
Morning.
We're here to talk about adventure paths and one thing to lay out.
This isn't the homebrewing panel?
What's that?
This isn't the homebrewing panel?
Well, we can change it. Whatever. There's going to be spoilers. We're going to talk about things that happen in adventure paths. So, earmuffs if you're playing in one of these. Otherwise, you're going to learn things that you might not want to learn.
We're also going to talk about things that are likely to happen in forthcoming adventure paths. So if you plan on playing one of those, the same rules apply.
Yeah.
And first we're going to introduce ourselves, starting with Mark.
He's got a mouthful of pop tart and soda. And
I'm Mark Moreland. I am the developer of the back matter of the APs, and I've been working on that since about halfway through the Hell's Vengeance AP, so that's three full APs now that I've worked on with that. So,
hi, I'm Crystal Frazier. I'm the art intern. I mean, the production assistant. I mean, the graphic designer. I mean, the technical resources. I mean, developer for the Pathfinder AP line. I've been developing the Iron Fang Invasion Adventure Path. I guess I've done it developing that, but we're not done putting it out to all of you lovely folk. And I am working on the adventure path we announced last night at the banquet.
Oh, what's that adventure path if anybody here wasn't? Oh, we're telling that later.
Yeah. Was anybody here not at the banquet last night? Oh, you're going to be happily surprised, I hope. Or you're going to hate me.
I'm James Jacobs. I'm the creative director for Pathfinder. The last adventure path I worked on was Hell's Rebels, and also went from that on to the redo for Curse of the Throne.
I'm Adam Daigle. I'm managing developer for Pathfinder, and I did the back matter for the adventure paths for the last few years, and then James wrote up the outline for Strange Aeons, and I took that and ran with it, and I'm also lead developer on Ruins of Aslan that we talked about a little bit at the banquet. And announced 1 year ago.
No, we announced Ruins of Aslan at Gen Con.
Was it?
Oh. Yeah. Yeah. Remember,
my APs
are the ones we announced at PaizoCon, and everybody's excited about them for 6 weeks, and then Gen Con happens, and they forget about my APs.
Yeah,
no.
And
true.
Then crystals get loved.
It's okay. I'm used to the abuse.
Hey, abuse.
All right, so with Ruins of Aslan, some of that was at the banquet last night. Mm-hmm. If any of you were in the art preview panel, you saw some of the covers and stuff for that, some of which I had not seen the finals of until someone at my banquet table was like, look at this, and I was like, I haven't seen that yet. but that one kicks off with it is Terra Incognita. It's, you know, there's you start off with the Lost Outpost written by Jim Groves, where the PCs start off on the deck of a ship looking at a colony that they were supposed to help create. And they were the second wave, and they show up and no one's there, and they have to figure out what happens. After that comes Into the Shattered Continent, written by Robert Brooks. And sorry, I had a cheat sheet and I totally lost it, so I had to recreate it real quick. The third book is The Flooded Cathedral, written by Miko Kallio. And where
I lost mine last year.
Confusing people.
Huh?
Keep going.
I know. And then Sins of the Saviors.
fourth one is City in the Deep, written by Amber Scott. The fifth is Tower of the Drowned Dead by Ron Lundeen. And the sixth is Beyond the Veiled Pass by Thurston Hillman. That fella.
So if you don't like it, get thirsty now.
Yeah, it's too late.
Not now, wait, wait, please.
Too late, you already wrote it.
And yeah, five out of the six authors are here at PaizoCon.
Nice.
That's true.
Yes.
That's
true. But yeah, enough about that. Let's talk about Tal'Dorei.
Yes! Wait, that's a spoiler. No, I was going to go into this whole, like, dramatic spiel, like, hey, there's, like, five major intersea nations, and we've developed all but one of them, and we've heard your complaints, and, like, so the next AP is exactly what you've been asking for, Cheliax 3! But you spoiled it.
The next
AP is War for the Crown, and specifically the Crown of Tal'Dorei, which is our... It's going to be a big... We say intrigue, but it's not going to just be intrigue. There's going to be lots of stabbing people who disagree with you. There's going to be exciting chases. There's going to be... Gosh, what else is there going to be? There's going to be antics involved in disguise. There's going to be sabotage.
Skullduggery?
Yeah, oh, we're going to dugger your skulls.
All right. Is there going to be a gargantuan Lovelorn?
Oh, no.
From the broken heart of the first Titan to have had their love dashed to the rocks.
All right, well, okay.
See,
now
it's really
the boss
a shame that James is no longer working on the AP.
Yeah. All right, now the boss of the first AP is a gigantic undead beating heart spider.
Yeah.
That's going to be what, CR 12?
Nah. You can reduce it to dice.
Anyway, so Ben... The design philosophy we've been keeping around the office is basically James Bond meets Game of Thrones, because you're not going to be the candidate for president, emperor. Going to be the candidate for empress yourself. You are her shadowy cabal who makes things happen while she is doing her campaigning and shaking hands and trying to push forward, like, with allies and averting a full-on civil war, even as other people are like, no, I'm clearly the candidate. Or I'm clearly the next person in line for the heir. God, it is way too early to have a... have
drink
to think about
know things.
I don't even schedule morning panels right after the banquet.
Yeah.
So anyway, the first... It kicks off in Pathfinder 127 with Crownfall, written by this man. And
this one you can hit me for. Yeah.
Crownfall. And in case it's not obvious, the crown that is falling is going to be Emperor Stavian. Grand Prince Stavian the Third. Yeah, not the first. He's been gone a while.
And the second has been gone a while.
So you start off at a nice, polite, senatorial dinner, mingling, rubbing elbows. Just having a nice time, and then...
Like you do with senators.
Yes, absolutely nothing of interest happens, and then you go home and get a good night's sleep. No, just kidding. Assassins break in, and everything goes to hell, and then you're trapped in a death senate and have to escape.
Death senate.
Copyright that.
After that, there is Songbird Scion Saboteur, written by Rich Pett, where now that you have... accidentally proven how valuable and resourceful you are recruited into Eutropia's spy corps to basically go and reclaim her family's estate that is being squatted on by nobles loyal to her father and a bunch of other jerks who refuse to give it up now. And you've got to mingle with them and convince them you're their friends and, like, participate in tournaments and go to fancy parties and... And then betray them. Also, well, sneaking around and fixing up all the infrastructure they've let slip and slaying the monsters they've let run free, eating their peasants. And
oh, you gotta leave the monsters to eat the peasants, then you don't have to later.
But why would you eat the peasants?
They're yummy.
They're stringy.
Just get some floss, you'll be fine.
All right.
They're stringy enough to be floss.
Peasant roast.
After that, we have The Twilight Child, written by Ron Lundeen, where now that you have kind of secured Eutropia's like geopolitical power base, you are sent out to help her recruit neighboring provinces to join her side as this question of who's going to ascend to the throne polarizes into two major camps. And you arrive in Zamar. Was it Zamar?
Zamar is later.
Oh, no, it's...
Yanmas,
thank you. That's why you do the back matter. Mm-hmm. You arrive in the city of Yanmas to basically ask for their help to find out that your rivals are doing the exact same thing. So you have to expose your rivals' corruption while helping the city solve their problems so that they can see that Princess Eutropia is a friend of the people. And along the way, you get to stab divs and fight a drake and... Oh gosh, what else? This is being written by Ron Lundeen, so it is like all over the place.
And he's here,
wackiness.
So you can bug Ron about it.
Yeah, if you want to find out what's in it, go ask Ron.
He won't tell you. He's under NDA.
But yeah, the big twist that happens here, and this is going to be spoilers, you find out that Princess Eutropia's dead little brother isn't actually dead. So that adds a further complication to who inherits the throne, because, I mean, Eutropia can only inherit the throne because of, like, brand new laws that not everybody agrees on, it's not traditional, but now we have a real prince, so we don't need those laws. So, after that, Pathfinder 130, we come to City in the Lion's Eye.
Now Zamar.
Now you go to Zamar, which is the power base for your primary rival, which I didn't think to write down his name, and we've been stumbling over it all through development.
It's a surprise.
Yeah, Scar.
Who's the author of this one?
City in the Lion's Eye is being written by Miko Callio.
Who's right there?
Yes, hi Miko.
Get him.
Sorry, you said Zamar, and I got all excited.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you bust into the city of Zamar, which is the power base for your rival, and while you're there, the first thing you do is you take out, like, his spymaster, only to discover that his spymaster had his own conspiratorial circles working to take over the Empire under the province of manipulating this guy. And so you've got the option of impersonating his spymaster to completely defuse his entire bid for the throne.
Or to take out his spy network.
Or yes, you
can do that instead.
You can use the resources he has to hunt down his spy network in the city instead. And they're both fun. I just happen to like plots with disguises.
I know. No one falls for it when you wear that fake mustache into the office.
Everybody
by the way.
Loves the fake mustache. I don't own a fake mustache. You're thinking of my brother Christoph.
Oh yeah.
So, unfortunately, as some of you who have played Tomb of the Iron Medusa might recall, it is known by certain people that the Stavian line might not have the most solid claim to the throne, and it is known by your political rival, shortly before you eliminate him, that the Stavian line doesn't have the firmest claim to the throne. And by taking him out, you unleash a bunch of fail-safes that release this information to the general public. So now you have to prove, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that Princess Eutropia is the rightful heir to the throne. And the only way you can do that is in Pathfinder 131, The Reaper's Right Hand, where you go to the City of Axis to find the first Taldan Emperor and get his blessing. Except it turns out he's missing. after that...
The author?
Oh, sorry. Reaper's Right Hand, written by our very own John Compton.
There were knives involved in figuring out who got to write an adventure on Axis.
Oh, man. How's that healing up, by the way?
It's fine.
So... After you get back to the material plane, Pathfinder 132, The Six Legend Soul, written by Amber Scott, our guest of honor. See, I won't forget her.
Yeah.
You discover you have gotten back too late, and a horrible series of events has culminated between the lost prince that you found and the assassins you thought you'd completely unraveled in City in the Lion's Eye, and the, like, shadowy circle of conspirators you found notes about in the second adventure. It's all come to a head, and now Princess Eutropia is dead, her soul is nowhere to be found, and her little brother is installed as the new emperor. You have to figure out what happened to Eutropia's soul, because she's not quite dead. She just doesn't have a soul.
Mostly dead.
Yeah. Still a little alive. So this is...
I think not having a soul is a requirement to be a head of state, though, isn't it?
No. That's awesome.
Only in Taldor.
Okay.
Aww, made it real.
So, yeah. I mean, there's not a lot more I can share without tons and tons of spoilers and also, like, a big Venn diagram and notation chart that I have at my desk. But that's the rise and fall of it.
And I really wanted us to call it the War of the Crown so that the abbreviation everyone would use would be WOTC, just to confuse everyone.
Yeah, Eric nixed that.
Yeah, for some reason Eric decided that wasn't the best idea.
It's a funny idea.
Oh yeah.
Why didn't you recruit me to help that? That would have been fun.
Man, I think the title of this AP is what we argued about the most the whole time.
I think it was, yeah. We at one point had like 20 different suggestions.
Yeah, they were up on the whiteboard and we were arguing and like, you can't call it War for the Crown, that's too generic. Plus the format is of the.
Which we haven't done for a while.
Yeah.
Actually, have we ever done that for an AP title? We've done it for a lot of adventures.
Rise of the
Rune Lords. Yeah.
Curse of the Crimson Throne.
Yes, we have. Wrath of the Righteous. There we go.
Now
I stand corrected. It's early.
That's what adventures are called. Noun of the adjective noun.
Yeah.
Did we do any of that? I was specifically trying to avoid that, and I didn't do any! Yay!
Yeah. Yay! I did one, apparently.
Oh.
Tower of the Ground Dead.
You get so. One.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very dramatic. So, yeah.
Right,
this,
so yes, this is
what the dev pit sounds like pretty much all the time.
Yeah.
It's like,
which is why the editors are always coming around the corner and saying, inside voices.
Yeah, I'm like, Adam, did I do the thing?
Yeah. That was a good movie.
You didn't, John Carpenter did the thing.
Oh. All right, so yes, this is a Q&A. Let's start.
I nominate you to pick questions.
What?
You. Me? You are the pointer.
All right.
Given the political chaos
mm-hmm.
going in Taldor, can we expect to see the former Taldoran territories playing in the skullduggery as well?
We're trying to keep it... I see what you're asking. We feel like we've done way too much Cheliax lately.
Well, I'm not
especially.
Thinking about Cheliax. I'm more thinking about Andoran, Galt, and Kadara.
Kadira. Yeah.
Galt's
got their own shit going on.
Yeah.
Kadira does play, I won't say a major role, but they're at least a fairly big side player that comes up in the middle of the adventure.
Yeah, I mean, one thing with Kadira is that they're the continually, you know, saber-rattling at the border nation for Taldor. And you do go to Zamar, which is the military city near the border,
mm-hmm.
basically where Taldor has for centuries amassed their strongest army in an effort to waylay the potential Kadiran invasion.
Yeah.
So it's involved, but you don't go to Kadira. You're not... There's no Kadiran invasion that's happening at this time. So, you know, that... We passed around some of those ideas, but I think we decided that it would be too much of a distraction from the theme and the feel of the adventure, which is really about the political intrigue.
Taldor needs to get its own shit in order before they go invading anyone else.
Yeah, he made that mistake many times in the past.
Yeah, there's a fairly large plot element where Princess Eutropia is the reformer, and like we're going to focus on getting our own shit together, and her rival is the big military commander, Pyrathius!
That's his name.
Sorry, we've only mentioned him one place, but we've established in canon that he is basically Stavian's heir select. So, Pyrathius is the military commander and keeps the nation safe from Kadira. So, once it falls into chaos, Kadira starts, like, rattling their saber again, and Taldor gets nervous. So, of course, they're going to back Stavian. And that's at a plot point
Pyrathius.
Pyrathius.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Nothing gets votes like being strong against whatever it is people are afraid of.
You made a real attempt.
Thanks, Mark. Yeah, right. I mean, that's actually a challenge that
we're trying.
That we're facing is, you know.
Don't let.
How do we tell this type of story in the current political climate without it becoming a commentary on real life? And it's really hard. And yeah. So I hope that we get it right. just because we would rather people play the adventures and enjoy the adventures in the made-up world and have it as an escape. But sometimes real events do make it difficult for the stories we had already planned to come to fruition without.
I think we were like 3/4 of the way through plotting this out and outlining it, and then.
And then the election happened, and we were like,
"Oh,
how is this going to impact the story?"
All right, so you.
So the cover shows a bunch of knights clashing. Is there going to be any type of mass combat in this adventure path, or?
That's just a mock-up cover that we're currently using. That was the original cover of Taldor
Echoes of Glory,
which was the 3.5 player companion about Taldor from like 2008.
This is much more of like a spy intrigue action movie.
You certainly will have influence over armies, but the PCs themselves aren't necessarily going to be commanding them. You're more the agents of the big power players, and so Eutropia has generals who are allied with her, and she may tell the generals, hey, go take your armies over here to secure this town or this province, but you're going to be on your own like special elite mission to do something else.
Yeah, she's going to dispatch armies, and your job is to get ahead of the armies and take apart the enemy's catapults and poison their water supply.
Whoa. What if I want to play a paladin?
Mark, don't make this a paladin threat.
We're trying to make sure there are options for a lawful, good solution to all your problems. I can't guarantee that everything you do will be perfectly lawful good at all points.
But everything I ever do is lawful good, Crystal.
When you play the Game of Thrones.
Sometimes the throne plays you.
All right, so actually on the back.
So for those of us who are a little bit behind, or very much behind, in our understanding of political history about Valyrian and the Pathfinder and the Red, where do we start to sort of get up to date on understanding these geopolitical factions and the falling outs between these nations?
Yeah, I would say the best source to really just get an idea of the big picture is the Inner Sea World Guide, which is our hardcover campaign setting.
It's also the most we've published on Taldor.
Certainly the most that doesn't have a bunch of, subtle retcons that have happened over the years. And so that's got information about the history of the whole region. It's got a write-up of Taldor itself, as well as all of its former vassal states that have since broken off. So I would say that is certainly the best place to get a baseline of what's going on in Taldor as well as the entire region. And then if there were one adventure that you might want to play as a lead up to the AP, I would say Tomb of the Iron Medusa, which is a 14th level adventure.
It's a high level one.
It's relatively high level, but you could run it as a standalone thing. And that delves into some of the history of specifically the current ruling family of Taldor and some secrets about their lineage.
Mm-hmm. As sort of a follow up to that, do you sort of consider the Inner Sea World Guide a comprehensive primer?
Oh,
yeah,
absolutely.
That's the book's primary purpose. Yeah. And you can also check out PathfinderWiki.com, which has drawn information from other sources as well. So, you know, in addition to the World Guide, if you want other information, you can go down a lot of rabbit holes on the wiki and find stuff there, and that'll point you to other sources. You can just check what, you know, what references are being, you know, cited, and go look at the source material as well.
Yeah, the long and the short of it is Tal'Dorei is the oldest nation on the continent, and they just exploded onto the scene, and they had innovative civic design and city design and military tactics, and they just spread everywhere and conquered half the continent. And that was 4,000 years ago, and they've just kind of rested on their laurels since then, and their empire has been slowly shrinking.
Yeah, so think like Byzantine Empire and like the British Empire between the wars. You know, when they're slowly losing, you know, territory around the world, but are trying to still claim that the sun never sets on the Tal'Dorei Empire. Then in terms of flavor of the nation itself, like Sun King era France, where the aristocracy has extreme wealth and is very concerned with their appearance and throwing the best parties and the, you know, their status among themselves, while the wealth disparity between them and the peasants is huge, and the aristocracy is just sort of letting the momentum of this thousands of years old empire continue to run the country while they throw parties, and the peasants are just sort of ignored. So, you know, in one of their vassal states that broke into an ongoing civil revolution, but in Tal'Dorei it's pretty much just the bureaucracy that's keeping things going, and that's all going to get shaken up when there's, you know, this political upheaval at the top.
Mm-hmm. All right. Actually, Ray's had his hand up for a little bit.
Okay. So I actually had a question coming into this place, but now I have a totally
different. Now you have
so
new questions.
This one's more important. In the Eutropia's soul missing, you know, whatever kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
Is there any kind of tangential involvement with the Daemons or even Norgor in that situation, by chance?
Not in this one. But Norgorber features in the Reaper's right hand.
Yes. Okay. Norgorber does keep his divine realm on axis.
Okay, yeah. It's just funny because I've got this tie-in with a current gang, because we're in Tal'Dorei, and it's Temple of Elemental Evil, and we replaced Eutropia with Prince Thrommel, and Eutropia got turned into a vampire, and we had to get her back and, you know, resurrect. Yeah, so.
No, this is very much a case of Tal'Dorei has hundreds of secret societies and conspiracies of nobles who think they're the real power brokers behind the throne. And this is what happens. This is basically a story of, like, two factions fighting for who gets to be the heir to the country. And in the background, one of these hundreds of conspiracies who think they're the real power for the throne accidentally fucks with things they should not mess with. And it gets much worse.
Did someone weaponize a final line?
You had a...
Yeah. First of all, I love the idea of this AP. I got really excited at the banquet last night. My partner and two of my friends were at my table, and as soon as it was announced, they all just sort of turned their heads in unison to stare at me. And my partner's like, okay, you can run this one. It sounds like there's a lot of factions by your description. But it seems also to function pretty heavily on backing Princess Eutropia.
Mm-hmm.
And as a GM for this, do you have to watch out for parties maybe trying to back a different faction, or are they pretty much designed to be people the PCs are going to load on site?
A lot of them are basically designed to be kind of detestable. A lot of it starts out with, I mean, everybody's using the agents, are relying on the agents that are valuable to them already, and you start out having been relatively low-lying agents. You're working for Princess Eutropia without necessarily realizing it.
Yeah, you might be like political aides, you know, for a senator, yeah. And not know necessarily that what you were doing was already helping Utropia your entire, you know, political career. And then once it's revealed that, like, oh, the people that we've been working for are allied with Utropia, like, you're definitely already set on that path. When we were originally brainstorming the AP, one thing that we talked about was giving PCs the option to back whomever they wanted. And the problem with that is that we can't publish three different APs with three different sets of enemies based on who you choose. So we did sort of have to pick one.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would certainly be possible for you to reflavor or spin some of the conflicts differently if you wanted to give your players that option, but it would require a lot of work on the GM's part.
Yeah, one thing that I assume we're also going to do with the player's guide is with the traits, we're going to set it up so that your players and the characters will be predestined to a certain extent to want to do this story. That's something we have to do for all adventure paths is we need to know what stories we want to tell, and you as the GM should make sure your players know what they're getting into. Like for Skull and Shackles, you don't want to just spring that adventure path on somebody without telling them that it's a big pirate adventure, because you might get somebody who's like, I want to play a lawful good paladin who's afraid of the water, and then they can't play that. And so that goes for pretty much every adventure path. There's a certain there's this element of GMs wanting to keep everything about the plot that the player characters are about to get into secret. But that's one of the best ways to make your campaign die an early death, because the player characters, if they have no idea what they're getting into, they're going to make some character that is likely not going to fit into the storyline. So I would check out the player's guide when we get that up. We put information in there to help you guide expectations and make sure the players play the characters they want to play that are going to work within the confines of the story.
Yeah, and overall the expectation is... Well, one, narratively, by the end of the first adventure, Utropia is the only candidate for Emperor who has not tried to kill your PCs. So that seems like good career... Or that seems like a stable career path. But also, the assumption is your PCs, whatever their motivations, are either really out to improve their lot in life, and Utropia is the one who's got to basically start from the lowest... and work her way up the most, so she is the candidate who will recruit people who wouldn't appeal to, like, the super established general of the army or any of these other nobles. So she is the one...
She's the champion of the underdog.
Yes.
So as first level PCs, it seems like she might be a better person to ally with than the general who just wants to hang out with other generals that your PCs will not be at first level.
Yeah. The guy who wants to hang out with all the other 12th level characters.
Right, and who wants to kill your PCs.
And also there's, narratively, like Mark said, we decided, early on we thought, oh, let's make three distinct candidates that you can back. But then we thought, well, like, as far as the story of our world goes, where do we want to take Taldor after this AP? And ultimately, we kind of wanted Taldor to stop just being the nation everybody jokes about being full of fops who were eating silver tea sets for breakfast.
Hey, it's a world of pure imagination.
And the way to do that is to
not have an incompetent corrupt person in charge.
Yeah, put in like an idealist who is going to try and challenge the system that's going to generate a lot more conflict in the next few decades.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then,
what's everyone's favorite AP and why?
Like parents, you don't have a favorite.
That's bullshit.
As someone who has never developed the adventures in an adventure path, I can have a favorite. But I don't know what it is. So
James, what's your favorite?
Two or three.
My favorite change is whenever I'm working on one. When I start working on Adventure Path, that's my favorite. And then when I'm maybe like 2 or 3 weeks into it, it's my least favorite and I hate it. And then once I'm done with it, I hate it really. But then once I step back and look at it, I am pretty proud of it. And so right now, the last one I worked on was Hell's Rebels. I'm pretty proud of that one. In part because it was the one that had the 100th volume of Pathfinder, and I got to put my character on the cover. So that was pretty rad.
I'm going to go with Curse of the Crimson Throne. I think it's just a really fun, classic, urban, all-over-the-place wazoo adventure, and I loved running it, and my players loved playing it.
And I'm going to use James's metric and say Ruins of Aslan. That was the first... Strange Aeons was the first adventure path that I developed, and James did the outline for that and helped me through that a lot, so thank you.
You're welcome.
But Ruins of Aslan was like my creation. I came up with the outline and the idea. Well, we all did, and the you know, that's what we do. But yeah, so Ruins, which you'll see in August.
Yeah, and I think my favorite is probably Kingmaker, just because it was the first of the Pathfinder era campaigns that really just like hit home what potential there was in the world for the players to make a difference. And it's, you know, that campaign where it's the most sandboxy, it's the most, the players have the most agency, I feel like. You know, it's the exact opposite of a lot of our other APs where we set up a specific alliance that you have from the start, like with War for the Crown. If you want to establish your kingdom to be one way, that AP gives you the opportunity to do that. So,
right.
I was going to ask, going back to the Tal'Dorei War for the Crown, any connection to the Armies of Exploration?
There will be a lot of mention of the Armies of Exploration and the treasures they brought back. One of the elements we're trying to work in is an idea called relics that are magic items that, due to their like historical significance or their tie to the zeitgeist, have gained extra magical power from basically the reverence and awe that people have invested with them. And some of these are going to be callbacks to the Armies of Exploration or the founding of Tal'Dorei or other major historical events. A lot of
wars that they took place in the Shining Crusade and things like that.
Yeah, and the idea is the more you do things associated with the origins of a relic, the more powerful it becomes.
Okay. Anyone? Question? All right.
They re-released 2 APs, and if you had your choice of an AP you could go back and like redo, what would you choose?
This sounds like a James question.
Second Darkness. it's one that I've always had a really I've always loved the storyline of Drow and all of that, and I want to we did a lot of experiments with Second Darkness that I think were failures. Like we had in the gap between Adventure 2 and Adventure 3, we built in an experience gap where you end Adventure 2, I think, at 6th level, and you have to be 8th level to start the next adventure. And the idea was that this is a place for your GM to build their own adventure and further customize things. And that was a terrible mistake, because people play adventure paths not to, you know, they want to enhance and adapt the storyline to themselves, but a lot of the people who play adventure paths, myself included, run them because the work's done and they can tailor. They don't have to build everything up from scratch. Plus, that gap made for a really disconnect between the first two adventures, which were based in the town of Riddleport, and then after that, it shifts to other parts of Varisia and the world. It also, I think, mishandled the way elves exist in Galarian. One of the big troubles we had early on in defining Galarian was defining it as our setting rather than just another version of Forgotten Realms or Greyhawk or Lord of the Rings or something like that. And we really wanted to establish our own identity for things like that. And for elves, for example, it wasn't that they come from the Fey realm and they're all attached to nature. The elves in Galarian and Pathfinder are aliens, in effect. They're from another planet. And I've been a fan of elves from the start, mostly because they can be so many multi-class characters back in first edition D&D. But I just also just really like just a lot of their values and their beauty and their artistry and all that stuff. And the fact that they're chaotic good, that's kind of my favorite alignment. But in Forgotten Realms and in Greyhawk and in Lord of the Rings, elves are not portrayed as chaotic good. They're more chaotic neutral, or actually they're more lawful neutral in a lot of cases, where they're super bound to tradition, they're isolationist, they're afraid of, they're kind of haughty, they don't really like involving other people and stuff like that. And that doesn't feel to me very chaotic good. Chaotic good is more of like, on the bad side, it's like the prankster who messes with you. On the good side, it's the friend who will do anything, break laws to support you or whatever. And I wanted elves to basically be that type of character. And in that early time, we didn't really, I was unable to convey that to a lot of the authors. So it kind of got this whole progression going of elves being not really what I envisioned them to be. And so with Second Darkness, I'd like to not only go back, shore up that adventure gap diaspora thing in the start, and fix some of the first time you really go to Kyonan, the queen throws you in jail, and that's just not the type of way that I wanted to go across. I wanted you to be
friends
with
the barrels barrels down the river, right?
No. and on top of that, I think the political and just all of the climate of society, our real society, has changed so much in the meantime, is that I want to do something about, and we're doing a little bit of this in Adventurer's Guide, and that's like, address the fact that the drow as evil elves that are black-skinned is something that I think it makes me really uncomfortable, and I want to do something about, try to re-spin that to address it. You know, that's something that I think we need to leave behind and go forward and do something new. So.
What about pink drow?
Aw. I just made mine gnomes. Gnomes turned to Darrow.
Yeah.
That's high.
Seems like if they're underdark, should be more albino.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of it is the whole idea was that we hadn't done anything with drow because up to that point we were kind of holding that card back, because back in the magazine era, because of Dritzt and all of that stuff, whenever we put a drow on the cover, that issue of the magazine sold incredibly well.
It's like gorillas on comic books in the 1960s.
Exactly the same thing. And so we were like, well, we were still getting established. We're like, well, let's use the big bullet. Let's use drow, because that's something that we know the magazine sold a lot of. It's a nostalgia thing, because it goes back to the roots of D&D, and it's open content, so we can play with it. So anyway, second argument. All right.
Just following up from the question there, the updated bound volumes, given a lot of work, they said will have to be redone to Second Darkness. Is there on the radar to redo Legacy of Fire, which is...
So when we first did Rise of the Rune Lords as a collection, we didn't really know what we were getting into. and we didn't have as many people on staff. Since then, we did Curse of the Crimson Throne, and the experience in building Curse of the Crimson Throne was not really disruptive at all. I mean, we had enough people to more or less handle things. I was able to basically move off the Adventure Path line at that point and focus on Curse of the Crimson Throne with Crystal and Adam and Mark taking over the Adventure Path stuff, and Rob at that point was working on it. So going forward, we have the capacity to do these big compilation books. We just have to know in advance that that's gonna be one of our hardcover slots for the year, rather than just throw it on an already full schedule. Since we schedule pretty far out in advance, we know what we're doing over the next 2 or 3 years already, and we don't really announce that publicly, so I can't really say if we have plans or not. It's certainly possible. It's not really something, I mean, there's basically three factors that determine whether or not we'll do one of these hardcovers, and one of them is the original set sold out and not available? There a perception that the public would really want something like that? And do we have the time to do it? Is it the right time to do it? And right now, those three things do not exist for any Adventure Path, and probably won't for a couple of years.
Kind of following up on the previous question, what would you say in general doing all the Adventure Paths are the biggest lessons you've learned to apply for your future Adventure Paths?
he doing?
What was
being
the
distraction?
Thirsty. Thirsty, you're fired!
Biggest lesson kind of from some of the regrets, perhaps, and dislikes of previous adventure paths to incorporate into future adventure paths.
Mine, I guess, would be not hiring somebody that I've never worked with. And that's burned me a couple of times. And since then, in recent years, we really work with a lot of authors. And before somebody gets to write an adventure path, they have to prove to us that they can actually turn over something. So we make sure they do several Pathfinder adventure paths, our Pathfinder scenarios for the society, Pathfinder Society.
Sometimes a module.
Modules, yeah. Monsters, a lot of assignments for hardcover books or campaign settings. It's never the first thing somebody writes anymore. Mm-hmm. And for a while, we would basically not really do it. We were kind of building up our own stable of authors at that point, but that burned us really hard several times in the early days. That's...
And that does show with some of the
hard
stuff.
Yeah.
I'd say one of the things I learned, which, hey, I'm only on, partway through my second one, but one of the things that I... from the outset, one of the things I really enjoy is seeing a lot of collaboration with Ruins of Aslan. I had all of my authors working, and we were using Basecamp to collaborate. And seeds that come, that finally come to fruition in the sixth one were planted in the first, and then in the fourth book, that there was a lot of communication between the authors, and that shows in the text. So I think it makes it a richer story having that. And so I will continue to encourage collaboration with my authors.
Grabbing's on.
Okay.
Yes.
So yeah, that's something that I learned in my small time of doing this, and I'm definitely gonna enhance that going forward. Sorry.
You're
I should have talked for 10 more seconds and you should have finished.
No, it's okay. I completely interrupted you by my fritter dance.
The fritter dance.
This is what everybody's takeaway from this panel is going to be. Crystal Frazier's amazing fritter dance.
As a sort of follow-up or a tangential line to that, would you say that how much in the initial design, when you're working with the various authors and handing out, okay, this volume for this volume for that, the tie-in between not just going from volume one to volume two, volume two to volume three, mm-hmm. but things that not even just foreshadowing or whatever for volume one that we'll see again in volume five or six, but just things so that a DM can know about that a little bit, hey, this is some things in volume five, volume six, how can I, incorporate that somehow in the periphery of volume one or volume two? How much communication do the individual authors do before hand? And how much do you guys...
As much as we can encourage them to do. I mean, generally a full AP is assigned all at once, like all six adventures. So we have written, or I've never written, these three have written very extensive, like sometimes 40 or 50 page outlines for the entire thing. And they'll talk, that volume, the outline for volume one will say, this character is going to play a role later. And all the authors receive both the outline for their specific adventure as well as the entire adventure path. And they know who's writing the other volumes. And we definitely put them in contact with each other, like Adam said, through Basecamp.
I use Slack for my authors, which is a chat room, basically.
Yeah, and that's part of the developer's job, is to make those ties and have a single voice and a single narrative across six or more authors. It certainly makes everyone's job in the office easier if the authors have already done some of that connection.
It's also one of the primary jobs of the developer themselves working on the adventure path, because the developer's the one who usually comes up with the outline, assigns all the products, reviews all of them, and then actually goes through and develops the text, and in a lot of cases that involves rewriting and redrawing maps and stuff like that. and whereas it's great to have all of the authors talking to each other, they're still six different brains, and the developer's job is to be the one uber overbrain across the whole thing to kind of make this the tenor of everything kind of fit together. And so you've got on one side the authors working together to tie things together, but then you've got the developer as the mastermind of all, basically trying, like, seeing something that happens in the last part, and then, like, since we get them all in theory in at about the same time, we can weave all those strings together.
Yeah. I think the biggest lesson I've taken away has been the distinction between a writer and a developer, because I was hired for this job because I'm a good writer, but there's a big difference between being a writer and a developer. It's like the difference between being an actor and a director. You can do both, but they're very different skill sets, and you have to stop thinking of yourself as a writer to be a good developer. Otherwise, you are going to look at a turnover and you are going to over-fiddle with it and change things and be like, no, this doesn't match my vision. And just, you can go down that rabbit hole and take an extra 6 weeks and basically rewrite an adventure from scratch, and then why are you even paying a freelancer? Yeah. Like, you're hiring these freelancers because they are some of our best writers and very talented, and they have their own visions, and your job is to just polish that up. But if you let the writer brain take over, then
sometimes not the lefter brain.
Yes, not the lefter brain.
All right, so let's question do, to save us from Mark's bad yeah. pun.
Let's do like some lightning
anyone,
round
anyone,
questions.
Please.
Yeah, so time for about one more question.
Well, we could do like maybe five more if we have short answers.
Yeah.
He's had his hand up in the back.
You.
Oh,
yeah.
You.
Oh.
In the middle, then.
This is strictly for role player. I'm not a writer, I'm not a developer, I don't do a lot of GMing. Two adventures that adventure paths that I really enjoyed were Skull Shackles and Carrying Crown. And both of those had an extra mechanism put in them. In Skull and Shackles, it was the fleet activity, which was kind of a different, there was an extra piece, it seemed like, put in there. You know, different rules applied and different ways of going about it, and had a lot of fun with it. And then in Carrying Crown, the caravan stuff.
Jade Regent.
Oh, right.
Jade Regent. I'm sorry. Jade Regent. Okay, so the caravan stuff. I'm curious. I always attribute when I see things that there was a reason for putting it in there. And I'm kind of thinking, is in when you put in something extra like that, it's a little different off of the beaten path, so to speak. What's the basis, the reason
the
for
the basis is really, I mean, we've been doing that from the start, really. And like the kingdom building stuff is important. Is a good example. For myself, the basis is I like designing rules. And as much as I like designing world content and stuff like that, those types of extra game elements is a place for us to actually become designers, as well as developers and writers and editors and all that. And it lets us play with the new game in a way that's relatively safe in the context of an adventure path, and it lets us discover and just build new elements. Some work really great, some don't work out that well, but it's a place for us to basically come up with new rules to tell storyline elements that the rules don't currently allow us to really tell. And so,
like in the fleet thing, I mean, just to add to it a little bit as a part of the discussion, in the fleet thing, we had a lot of fun, it worked out really well. In the caravan thing, we had to develop this terribly complicated spreadsheet to keep track of all these points.
Yeah, they don't always work as well as we want. So when we do those things, we also set them up as options too. Like for Jade Regent, there was this a relationship mechanic where you could track how the NPCs are interacting with the player characters and the caravan rules. But while they in theory enhanced it, you didn't need to use those rules to play. So if you're using those rules and they don't work for your game, you can throw them out and continue playing, or as you were saying, build on them. So it's kind of sort of a place for us to experiment.
Okay. Right. We'll do one more and then we got a break.
Yep.
So the next crew can come in.
Real quick one. We got a lot of good spoilery stuff for War of the Crown. Give us one or two really good spoilery things for Rune of the Sunrise.
You technically fight the end boss from the sixth adventure in the first adventure. Because it is a, spoilers, failed master. With
Wait, there's actually a Veiled Master this time? You sure it's not somebody pretending to be Veiled Master?
Veiled Masters don't exist. What are you talking about? No. So
don't tell them.
It's released from stasis. This is like the pre AP story. It's released from stasis by the first wave of colonists. It pops out and goes dominated. And then so the end boss of the first adventure is two dominated former colonists that you fight. Now with dominate person, the person dominating can sense through them and give commands. So that Veiled Master is sitting there, and when you end up at the end battle of the first thing is going, okay, yeah, swing your sword here, do this, do that. So over the course of the AP, evil GMs can go and collect all of the information about the PCs. So by the time you get to the last one, knows everything you can do.
Yeah. To borrow a Mass Effect reference, assuming direct control.
All right. So thanks everybody for showing up. Have a fun Sunday.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of the No Direction Podcast PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage, made possible with the help of Justin Sluder and Ryan Hiller of Geek Dad. To find more great Pathfinder audio, go to NoDirectionPodcast.com.